This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
The Scotland Outdoors Podcast from BBC Radio Scotland.
Anyone who was listening to me last week blowing about the bull that I was putting in, must be wondering how I got on. Well, pride comes before the sackcloth and ashes, or something. I was offered a respectable 1,700 guineas for my bull, but I turned it down. Here is my excuse. I had a bull on order from Switzerland, which was to cost £3,000. Now, it was not as good a bull as the bull I was selling at Perth, so I was better keeping my own bull and cancelling my import. Now here's the real reason. I was charged with driving my horse box down to Perth without a logbook. I had to sleep in the horse box, which was like an iceberg. I went to the herdsman's ceilidh, which was better fun that night than it was the morning after, and the judge didn't like my bull. So I sulked and went off home and took my bull with me.
That's the voice of Charlie Allen speaking on Scottish Farming News on BBC Radio Scotland in the 1980s. Charlie's been described as a lad of Perth, a true Renaissance man. He was a broadcaster, economist, farmer, writer, singer, sportsman, including world caber-tossing champion in 1972, and generally a bit of a legend where I come from in the northeast of Scotland. Charlie died recently, so we've decided to dedicate this edition of Scotland Outdoors to him. I'm Helen Needham, and I've been digging around in the BBC archive to unearth some of Charlie's programmes. I've also caught up with an old colleague and friend of his, Frieda Morrison. So let's begin with Frieda. She took over Scottish Farming News from Charlie, but he still contributed in his own inimitable way.
Meanwhile, in West Berlin, they've been holding their annual Green Week, despite the changes in the last few months. Charlie Allen's been enjoying the event across there, and this is what he found.
I wasn't just enjoying myself. For the Green Week's more than just the biggest food and drink fair in the world. As well as being the meeting place of East and West, it's an important venue for Europe's agri-politicians and bureaucrats. So, if you want to gauge the mood of the industry, Green Week's a good place to be. And the first straw in the wind's more like a big bale. As far as everyone here is concerned, every effort's to be made to help the eastern countries to develop their farming and their food marketing to bring them to the point where they can compete with us, both inside the EEC and in third markets. And you really have to go to Berlin to feel the strength of the green movement. For example, in the beef hall, they're doing a roaring trade in countryside posters. They show a landscape of pony trekking, cats and dogs at play, birds flying and even a peacock not flying, guides round a campfire and children playing shuttlecocks. Three ducks, two hens and a cock are all that remain of farming. They haven't quite gone that far yet, of course, and I enjoyed meeting a farmer who was looking after a big dun bull of the Deutsches Angus breed. Alf Lott Beckman came across the Angus part of the new breed when he was a prisoner of war in Northumberland.
I am a farmer's son, and so I stayed on a farm when I was quite happy there.
You didn't think of stopping in the UK, did you?
Yes, I did, but But another thing, people always think they have to get home first, and so...
How did you then come to have these Deutsches Angus?
I always thought about to have some Aberdeen Angus, but after 20 years I was able to manage to get them from a breeder in Germany. And after that I switched over to a Deutsche Angus because they are a bit bigger.
Did you cross your Anguses to get Deutsches Angus or did you buy them?
No, I bred them.
And what did you use to cross?
The Rotbund.
So these cattle, we're looking at some of your cattle now, and are this bull is yours?
Yes, it is.
Has he got a little bit of Rotbund in him then?
Well, it's great-grandmother was a Rotbund.
I see. Well, he's a tremendous big, long bull, isn't he?
Well, he is. I think he's the heaviest one here. 2,500 weights.
So what is the difference?
Well, I always think the quality of beef for the Deutsche Angus is quite good.
So how does it sell in the market? Do you get a premium from this?
Yes, you do. But it's not really enough, no. You know?
But farmers never get enough. Have you noticed that?
It's possible.
That was West German farmer Alflot Beckmann, who was taking part in a beef demonstration in three parts. There were the milk cows, the beef cows, and I quote, those kept mainly to maintain the countryside. I'm afraid that the Galloway, Highlander, Aberdeen Angus and Ling cattle were all in the third category.
Charlie Allen, one of the few to be disappointed in that third category. I'm sure the appropriate producers are delighted, since that's why they're getting the high prices here.
I have a lot of happy memories working with Charlie, co-producing and presenting Scottish Farming News together on Radio Scotland. I worked with him for almost 2 years and we had some amazing adventures. Charlie was never happier than we as us celebrating and singing and having gatherings. And it was a lot of fun. And whatever room he was in, people kent he was in there. He was a talented writer and a storyteller. And he knew his favourite stories that he loved to tell at the gatherings was about an event that happened at Smithfield Show. Now, one of the highlights of Scottish Farming News calendar was our visit to the winter show at Smithfield down in London. Nae for us the swanky outside broadcast unit. We broadcast to the nation from Smithfield each day from a 10x8 caravan in the car park. It was a very small studio. Now, the audio supervisor and technician on loan to us from BBC London was a young lad called Julian, who had the most wonderful Cockney accent. Now, remember, at that time, Scottish Farming News was broadcast twice a day. First bulletin at 6:05 in the morning, and another at 6:15 in the evening. And the evening slot was hard enough, but the early morning broadcast that had to be done live at Smithfield was a trachle. It was done by Rhoda, taking turns to get up early. And yup, to cut a long story short, this morning, Charlie slept in. So there was Julian in the caravan, waiting, nobody turning up. The clock was ticking, and it was half an hour broadcast time. Then Charlie leapt out of his bed and turned on the radio, thinking there was just going to be silence. But Charlie woke up to listening to Julian reading his script. Julian broadcasting Scottish Farming News to the nation in a broad Cockney accent. You see, Charlie had left his script in the caravan, luckily. And Jules, being a clever lad, took the script and proceeded to present the programme, reading out Charlie's script and playing in the tapes. The only thing was, he didn't have the time to change the script. Instead of saying so, Charlie asked the owner of the Champion Bull, Julian was broadcasting with the words in broad Cockney, so I asked the owner of the Champion Bull about the pedigree. And for the record, nobody complained. There was one farmer apparently said to Charlie, "Aye, Charlie, fair enjoyed the reports to Smithfield. But I didn't think much of yon lad you tried out as presenter to London." That was the only comment we had.
broadcaster Frieda Morrison, and you can hear more from Frieda on ScotsRadio.com. Let's hear more about Charlie's life now from the other side of the microphone. Here's a programme called Far From the Crowd, recorded in 1991, where Alan Wright visited Charlie's farm.
Hello again. Today I'm with my good friend and former BBC colleague, Charlie Allen. We're sitting at Little Ardo, a 250-acre family farm just outside Methlick in Aberdeenshire. When you start talking to Charlie, the problem's knowing where to begin, because it would be easy to fill a series as you trace a career and a life that encompasses economics, heavyweight athletics, folk singing, writing, broadcasting, and, of course, farming. And maybe it's the farming which brings out the real Charlie Allen. Little Ardo was the place which inspired a lovely, slim volume of poems called A Little Piece of Earth, from the pen of Charlie's mother, Jean Mackey Allen. And Charlie, this little piece of earth is quite important to you, isn't it?
That's right. My great-great-grandfather came here, I don't even know when, but in the first half of the 19th century. And I am now the fifth generation here, and I hope to pass it on to a sixth. And it is very important to me to keep that continuity going. And I may say that this is a product of my middle age and impending old age, I think, because as a young man, I would have said, what nonsense, you know, the farm doesn't pay, it's worth £250,000, sell it and go off rejoicing. But it would break my heart to do that sort of thing now.
When did that change come then? You spoke about middle age there. Is it something that comes with middle age, this coming back to your roots and the love of the land and that sort of thing?
Well, I was away being an academic until I was really mid-30s. I decided that I wanted to come back to Little Ardo. And there were all sorts of reasons for it. There were some negative ones in the academic field. I'd got a little bit disillusioned with that side of the thing. But what was really critical was that people of my generation, the young men who had stayed at home on the farm, they were all getting big government grants, putting up big sheds and making their farms terribly modern. And inflation was going on year by year. And the ridiculously expensive shed they put up one year, the next year, looked a bargain. Or at least 3 years later, it looked a bargain. My old dad was a writer, first and last, really. And he wasn't interested in modernising the place. He didn't build anything at Little Ardo in his time there, so that the farm was getting more and more old-fashioned. And at that time, there was a horrendous problem in passing land from one generation to the other because of death duties. But I thought that if the farm was to stay in the family, first of all, we ought to be getting on with modernising it, getting some sheds up. I mean, sheds were the big prestige thing, you know, a few great big sheds. And also that we should get on with the business of my buying my father out, so that it would be possible to keep the farm in the family.
That was in the early 70s that you gave up the academic career.
Yes.
But let's just quickly go back over that. You were in economics.
First of all, I liked playing games. Football, rugby, cricket, athletics, I played at university. But then, by great good luck, I got a very severe leg injury when I'd been my third year at the university. And this enabled me to give up all sport, and I put the same sort of competitive energy that I had been putting into the sport into studying, and got a good degree to everybody's amazement, including my own. And then I was offered an academic job in Glasgow University and took it. And I was a total of 17 years, actually, in universities. And I was fairly successful. I wrote sort of dismal books and got promotion and things. I was a senior lecturer before I was 30, which, you know, was quite good. The next step after senior lecturer was professor, and I observed that professors spent all their time in committees, meetings which went on and on, and academic meetings are really the worst thing imaginable, because everyone there is a professional talker. They don't think they've done their job unless they've talked for a long time, each on every item of business, and it seemed to me that the professor's life was just a dreadful one, and I had no interest, really, in making that next step.
What was the highlight of the academic career, then? I remember you telling me once about writing a book on economics that was translated into various languages, including Japanese, which was a bit of a feather in your cap.
Well, yes, it was a feather in my cap. It also paid quite well, as a matter of fact, because it was a Penguin. It was a Penguin book, and it sold 20,000 copies or something in Britain. And the Spanish edition sold well. I mean, there's a lot of people speak Spanish. What they made of my rantings on the theory of taxation, it was called. A crushingly boring book. I mean, I'm not terribly proud of it. The Japanese edition, I do have a copy on my bookshelf, and I'm quite proud of that. It looks very nice, the Japanese writing and so on. It's back to front, but I wouldn't know.
The academic life, of course, meant city life as well. Were you glad to put that behind you?
No, not at all. I spent most of it in Glasgow, and I really enjoyed it. I can't really explain why, but we had a very nice house in Pollock Shaws and in Hillside Road, a sort of fading Victorian street it was then. But we had a marvellous big house, which didn't cost a lot, except when we had to pay the rates. I don't know, we have all still got a great affection for Glasgow. And in fact, we had a couple of years in Dundee. And I mean, I thought Dundee was the last place in the world I'd want to go when I went there. It was just the work that took me there. And yet we were very happy there. So although I'm a product of the country and I'm happy to be in the country now, I've enjoyed town life as well, yeah.
The athletics that you said you gave up in your third year at university, were you into the heavyweight athletics at that time, or did that follow on later?
Yes, I did a little bit then, but there was no question of, you know, training all the year round at that stage. In the summer holidays from the university, I would then start do a bit of training and throwing and so on. And for some reason, it was a knee injury I got playing rugby, and for some reason I was able to do the heavy athletics. I was always handicapped by it. I could do the centre of gravity jumping up test. I could do about 28 inches off my good leg and only 3 off the one that was injured. But I seemed to manage to compensate for that. So, yes, I was doing the athletics even while at the university. And, in fact, I mean, you know, you get paid small sums of money at the Highland Games, and helped to finance my university career.
And the folk singing, did that start at university?
Well, of course, I was brought up on the farms in Aberdeenshire when it was still part of the living culture of the farms, and I learned a lot of my early folk songs in the farm kitchen, my granny's farm kitchen, and round the close on the farm, so that it started very early. Really, as regards getting up on a stage and entertaining people, that's much more recent. I think, really, if it started anywhere, it was when I was asked to do an after-dinner speech in England, and it was a long drive down. There were 3 of us in the car, and we composed this song, The Blue-Grey Coup, on the way down to this after-dinner speech. So instead of making the after-dinner speech, I just sang this song, and I think that was really the start of it. The song went down very well with the Galloway breeders, who saw it as a good advert for their product, or one of their products. And I think really that's what got me into the folk singing thing. I enjoy it. I may say I'd like to do more if I could.
Do you do that for fun now, or is it a way of recording what has happened and what is happening in the countryside?
The first time I recorded a collection of these songs, it was because I thought that the very rich heritage of folk songs in my area hadn't been recorded in a way that I would like to have them recorded, which I think, you know, should just be a very simple presentation in which the words are terribly important. As regards the songs I've written, I mean, I think I am actually quite proud of the fact that I have been able to add a little bit to the story of the development of our area with songs like The Blue-Grey Coup and Lonely in the Bothy, which tells about how the farm servants who used to have lots of pals on the farm are now isolated.
And you came back to the farm in 1973, I think. This was to go full-time farming.
It's a while ago now, but yes, it certainly was full-time farming. I mean, 16 hours a day, I would say. I had very ambitious plans for for the farm. I was going to have a tremendous number of sheds put up, and I was going to have intensive bull beef, at the press of a button. I was going to be able to lie in my bed and press the right buttons, and all these bull beefers would be fed, and I was going to have the greatest herd of pedigree cattle. I imported 7 different breeds from Europe, and I called it Charlie's Safari Park at one stage. Tremendous amount of money got spent. We had 700 cattle here, on 250 acres at one stage. But the thing that I can't say we didn't notice it, but it seemed to creep up awful quickly, was a thing called the overdraft. And just when this overdraft was getting to a critical stage, my dad decided that he would be better to get the hell out of it. So we had a negotiation in which I tried to give him as much as possible and he tried to take as little as possible. And eventually he went off to a well-earned retirement in Lincoln and left me with a colossal overdraft. Now, the sums might have worked out at the 10% that we did the sums at, but no sooner had the money been paid and the interest rate went up to, the highest we got to was 22.5%. And so my farming career from then onwards became slightly difficult, and my ambitious plans, were somewhat reversed. I had to get rid of some of these 700 cattle to bring the overdraft down. And I'm afraid to say that really the story of my farming on Little Ardo since that high point of, we had 3 men working and 700 cows, and the masons were here building stuff all the time, has been one of retrenchment and trying to get the overdraft paid off, the farm secured for another generation, and to get into the position to hand it on in good heart, but not highly stocked, to another generation.
And during that time of getting the overdraft down, that brought you to a new side to your career, to broadcasting, didn't it?
Well, that's right. I can't really remember exactly how the interaction was, but, we got the 700 cattle down to perhaps 150 cattle. And then, at that stage, I still had 2 men, and I had a bit of spare time. And I was able to get a job with the BBC, and that was grand. Because although they didn't pay me much, they did pay me more than a farm worker was getting, so that I could afford to pay this farm worker. But actually, it didn't work out that well, my being away. And I don't think we ever quite sold all the cattle, but we certainly reduced it further and put away the 2 men. And I sort of puddled about with a few cattle and worked allegedly full-time at the BBC.
That came to an end, and another short phase in your life when you went to Kenya.
My wife and I have always, she's always suffered from the cold, and I've always agreed with her that one day we would go and work somewhere warm. And in fact, I got the chance to go and work at the University of the West Indies, and much to my wife's horror, turned it down. And I also got a chance to work in the Treasury on Jersey, and to my wife's horror, turned it down. And she began to get desperate about this and eventually bullied me into an agreement that the first person to get a job somewhere warm, the other one would give up their job and go. So I said, yeah, I agree to that. And then it was not more than a couple of weeks after this that we were having breakfast together, and I wasn't paying a lot of attention, but I could hear she was speaking away behind the newspaper. And eventually, through my attention to the newspaper, I heard the phrase, "But it'll only be for 2.5 years," and I realised that I should have been paying more attention. Anyway, the lassie had gone and got herself a super job in Nairobi in Kenya, and so it was up to me to resign from the BBC, which I did with some regret, but I think I was ready for a change, either a change of broadcasting or I'd been doing the same Scottish Farming News programme for almost 5 years, and I think it was time for a change. And I may say it was just the right change, because my job in Kenya was to look after the houseboy cook and the gardener. And I found that all my friends said, "Charlie, you'll never manage to sit and your backside and do nothing. And they were absolutely wrong. I am ideally suited to a life of leisure.
At the end of 3 years, were you sorry to leave or glad to be home?
Well, I was very glad to be home, in fact. And it's hard to put your finger on why I should be glad to be back, because our standard of living dropped like a stone. The weather wasn't nearly so good. But I was very glad to be back. It's something to do with, although we had a wonderful time there and everybody was very nice to us, it just wasn't our home. We're always going to be welcome guests there rather than the people who lived there. And I really wouldn't like to be an immigrant anywhere.
Pretty well full-time farming, but time for some journalism, some writing, and one or two other projects apart from the regular columns that we see in the Press and Journal and the Glasgow Herald.
Well, that's right. I would like to be a best-selling author, and I've managed to get a publisher to accept a book. What I can't get them to do is to publish it. And I'm well on with writing another book, which will be a sort of a personal history of this farm and my family and my connection with the land. But the thing which I'm feeling very nervous about and I'm desperate to get on with, but can't because of the farming commitment, I've discovered my father, John R. Allen's papers, contain a great deal of unpublished work, some of which is just marvellous. And we are now well into the seventh consecutive year of profit. Now, it's not profit, so as you'd notice, but at least it's not a loss. And this is tempting me to think about getting a man full-time so that I can get free to have a couple of years to try and get on with my own writing, but also to make big progress with the old man's stuff.
Can we finish where we started? Your love of the land and perhaps the writing that goes with it. Is it all bound together?
Well, I'm not sure about that, but what I am sure is that when I was in Kenya and had loads of time to write about the land or to write about anything, I wrote very little indeed. And since I've come back and I've been terribly busy, I've written quite a lot.
You said that the great ambition in all this was to pass on the land to the next generation. How keen is the next generation on having this bequest?
Oh, well, it's worth a lot of money. I have four children. I think it would be fair to say two of them wouldn't have the place in a gift. But the other two, I think, would be very keen to have it and would have something of the same feeling as I have. And in fact, we have managed to con one of the next generation into taking up the burden of this farm on the understanding that it will not be their farm, it'll be the family's farm, and it'll be their obligation to pass it on to one of their children or one of their children's children.
Why should that be so important?
Well, I don't know. It's not something I can be rational about. I think the importance of the land to me is something like the importance of God to many people who are religious in the sense of being members of established churches. I am not religious in that sense, but I have this very strong feeling that there is something more important than my immediate comfort. And it gets expression in this strong feeling for this little piece of earth.
Charlie Allen speaking to Alan Wright at his farm Little Ardo near Methlick in Aberdeenshire. That's almost it for this edition of Scotland Outdoors. I'll leave you, though, with a story from Charlie, which was recorded for a regular programme he did on BBC Radio Scotland called A Story, A Song and a Poem. I'm Helen Needham. Thanks for listening.
Old Jimmy had been grieve at Little Lendrum for 38 years when Jukit, the farmer, decided to call it a day. Jimmy couldn't imagine why the boss thought he needed to retire, for God knows he'd never done a hand's turn and had left everything to his grieve. Everything except the profit, that is. And there'd always been plenty of that,
for it was a good farm and Jimmy was a good farmer and expected his staff to work as hard as he did. He always had the binder greased and ready to go the day the crop was ripe. The courts were always waiting for the cattle on the 1st of November, and nothing that was needed was ever lost or broken or borrowed. Maybe Jimmy had done just too well in making Alec Tuckett rich enough to retire, but that's what he did on the 28th of November in 1968. Now, at 63 years of age, Jimmy was just old enough to be getting another job, and yet just some young for the pension in a council house. And Tuckett, the old miser that he was, knew that right well. "Aye, Jimmy, you'll bide on a while and see to the rope and be caretaker kind of thing, know what I mean? I'll no be hard on you, but of course you'll just get an orra man's wage." Jimmy took Hobson's choice with an ill grace. It was an inauspicious way to run down 50 years of dedicated service, but what could he do? Now, the old Grieve had had a special ill will at the farm of Netherton. The rivalry found expression at the bull sales, for both places had pedigree shorthorns in the great days of that breed. But in fact it originated when Jimmy had given Netherton's Grieve a hiding at a Fian market in the 1920s. He never forgot, and certainly never forgave, or missed an opportunity to miscry Roch Netherton, as he called it. Now, Tuckett's plan was to cash all his own stock and rent out his grass. Old Jimmy would sort the fences, see to the waterings, and count the cattle every day. So imagine the chagrin of the old Grieve when he heard that, of all people, Roch Netherton had taken little Lendrum's grass. If there was any consolation in that humiliation, it was the scope it gave old Jimmy to vent his heavy sarcasm on Netherton's stock. Like the spring when the first of Netherton's dairy heifers arrived, down came the tail door of the float. Jimmy took one look and said as loudly as he might, "Oh, aye, here they come, the walking wounded." And certainly they were looking middling fair at best. And Jimmy was just the man to tell them. He rang up immediately. "Hello, Netherton here." "Aye, little Lendrum. You'll need to come doon and doze that heifer for worms." "Oh, dear. Not looking as well as usual, are they?" "Aye, just about the same." "Oh, dear. Well, now, let me see. Thursday, busy day, Friday. Tell you what, I'll send the chaps down on Monday. How's that?" "It's aye the same to me. But if you leave it till Monday, it winna be sic a big job." Then there was the time that he phoned up about the heifers being in calf. They were there to grow, not to calve, and yet every summer at least two or three calved. It was the great big Charley bull that Netherton had imported from France. Surely they've nae fences in France, Jimmy thought. Well, this spring the heifers arrived as usual, and Jimmy's quick eye soon spotted four in calf. He hastened to the phone. "Netherton here, good morning." "Aye, you'll need to come and take four of your heifers hame for their in calf." "Oh, no, James, quite impossible. Haven't been near a bull, you see." "Oh, aye," said Jimmy. "That's funny, for the look in calf to me, and there's 2 feet sticking out the back of ane of them." Jimmy liked fine to point out how incompetent Netherton's men were, but he didn't like the way they always made out that it was his fault, and that he was bothering them. So at last he stopped phoning. Netherton could easily afford to lose a heifer or two, and Charley Cross Frisian calves sold well even then for a quick deal. And I never did hear if Netherton's men noticed.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.